Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
I'm always thinking about culture. I was born in the United States to Nigerian parents. My parents started taking my siblings and I back to Nigeria at a young age just to connect with our relatives, our heritage, all of that. And, you know, in the United States, I deal with schisms between Africans and African Americans. You go to Nigeria where you're trying to explain African Americans to Africans. And so people are always like, oh, how do you come up with your stories? I'm like, oh, really? I don't have to come up with anything. I just have to look around. It's all there.
This is Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, a love letter to science fiction and the fans and creators who made it so, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. I'm Adam Savage, and on this episode, the international award-winning novelist Nnedi Okorafor sits down with me to talk science fiction and fantasy and how she gets into the psyches of misunderstood alien monsters. Nnedi's unique combination of science fiction and African mysticism brings a brand new diverse viewpoint, blasting our preconceived notions of modern-day Africa and helping change the science fiction genre, or as she says, science fiction is molting. Her books have won both Nebula and Hugo Awards, and in addition to her writing, Nnedi is helping shape a new wave of authors as a professor at SUNY Buffalo. Nnedi and I discuss her science fiction guilty pleasures and much deeper topics, including Afrofuturism and how the world of literary academia still sees science fiction as a lesser genre. Listen in as we take a closer look at the molting of science fiction. Here we go. Nnedi Okorafor, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. How are you today?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm very good. There's a lot I want to go over. I'm going to jump right in. Do you personally have a science fiction guilty pleasure?
Oh, man, that's an interesting question. And I had an answer, an immediate answer, which is like, wow. Yes, I think I do. I think I do. Well, I guess my guilty pleasure is robots of any kind running amok. They have to run amok.
Oh, okay.
They have to go wrong. They have to either go wrong or go and do things amongst themselves. I love that. I love artificial intelligence or physical robots, any kind of robots that just run amok. I enjoy that narrative every time.
So what's your favorite movie about robots going amok? Is it Terminator or is it The Matrix or is it something else?
Oh, man, both of those are some of my favorites. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Her. The movie Her.
Yes.
I loved that. That film, like, touched on so many of my fantasies and questions. Well, it's not those fantasies, no. But if you've seen Her, you'll know what I mean.
Understood.
But what I loved about Her is that it's like it hints at an apocalypse happening.
Right.
But it's nice. It's nice and calm and pretty in their colors. But look. Think about it closely. This is not good for humankind. I love that.
You have famously said that your Star Wars nerdiness skews towards the creatures.
Mm-hmm.
I am particularly fond of Chewbacca. I have two Chewbacca costumes. I've cosplayed as him. I've always said he's my favorite non-human character in film.
Awesome.
Who is your favorite creature?
Oh, my God. That's a great question. Who is my favorite creature? First answer that came to my mind was Yoda. I love Yoda.
Yoda's amazing.
I love Yoda. Everything about Yoda, even down to the fact that we don't know where Yoda came from. It's a mystery. And that he's small and just so... It's like the body that you're seeing there is not. It's just like a small percentage of who Yoda is. I tend to also like the random monsters. The monsters that are not central to the narrative at all, that are just... living their lives, doing their thing, like the monster on that asteroid.
And yes, then the worm.
The worm who's just there. And then the, of course, the trash compactor monster that I wrote about.
You wrote the story, The Baptist, for the Star Wars anthology.
Yes.
And what is it? Is it Diagona? Is that how you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Dianoga.
Dianoga. Yeah. That sounds better.
Yeah.
So, tell me about writing from the perspective of from Wikipedia's point of view, a non-sentient cephalopod.
I loved it. I did it like 3 times in Lagoon, where I wrote from the perspective of creatures of a tarantula, a swordfish, and a bat. Oh. And those were like some of my favorite parts to write in that book. So I should have known that I had a tendency for this. The narrative that I created for the Dianoga was really, I can't believe I wrote that. I can believe it, but it's like, I look at it and I'm like, this is so awesome. It was just like that kind of response. It was a really wonderful, surprisingly wonderful experience. Aww. I mean, that was just, it was fun.
Did you choose science fiction and fantasy as a backdrop for your characters, or did it choose you?
I think it chose me, because I look at my cultural background and I look at the initial stories that I started writing, and it's like I was born in the United States to Nigerian immigrant parents. And once the Biafran War, the Civil War, was over, my parents started taking my siblings and I back to Nigeria at a young age just to connect with our relatives, our heritage, all of that. And so while I was having my upbringing here in the United States and dealing with all of these very American issues, good and not so good, you know, we were going to Nigeria and I was seeing another part of the world where those issues are completely different, where most people in this country are black, you know, where they're mm-hmm. African. And so they did not have the issues of racism. Instead of racism, they had tribalism. And so I got to see this from a very young age. And so the world was always really big to me.
Mm-hmm.
And moving between cultures was always something that I had to do and something that came naturally to me, and dealing with cultural conflicts was always normal to me. So when I started writing, it was natural that the stories that I wrote took place on borders and dealt with conflicts and dealt with imagining, you know, what if, and then also having that Nigerian background, that those cosmologies and spiritualities influenced me deeply even before I realized it. So, you know, this idea of the fantastical being just a regular part of the world was natural for me. So when I first started writing, even when I would try to write nonfiction or memoir, I would have magical things naturally happening. So it's like, and then with science fiction, I wasn't really interested in writing science fiction until those trips to Nigeria where I would see technology at work in Nigeria, especially in the 90s. In a way that I wasn't seeing in the United States. And I started thinking about the fact that I wasn't seeing that in literature. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is not the Africa that I'm seeing in literature. Africa that I'm seeing in literature is often a place presented as the past or a troubled place. It doesn't have cell phones and isn't really engaged with the future. What I was seeing was very engaged with the future. So I wasn't seeing that. And so that was really what pushed me to start writing science fiction. So it's like, Both fantasy and science fiction did sort of kind of choose me as opposed to me choosing them.
I'm curious if there's a moment in your childhood, an origin story, when science fiction pulled you in.
Science fiction rarely appealed to me as a kid because it just seemed very white and very male.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It felt like in the worlds that were created were not accessible to me. It felt like I didn't exist in those worlds. Like and not just that I didn't exist, that I couldn't exist.
Right.
So I would read them and I would migrate towards narratives where either aliens or non-humans were the main characters. But it just didn't grab me. My wheels started really turning once I got a little older and we went in those trips to Nigeria where I was seeing the technology. That was really where, you know, especially cell phones, you know, where I would be in the most rural parts of Nigeria. Like I'd be in my father's village where there wouldn't be any electricity or running water and everyone had to have a generator and all of that. And just loving it. And then, you know, when cell phones arrived, you know, you would be in that environment and then you'd see a cell phone in the midst of all of that. It was just like, it was so cool. And like the juxtaposition between these old ways and these modern ways just and the way they coexisted comfortably was so cool. So I think that was really the catalyst for me. It was in the 90s.
especially since I know from technologists and futurists that in Africa, they've been utilizing cell phones for communications mm-hmm. networks in ways no one ever posited before the cell phone.
Yes. Yes. And that's so fascinating. It's because of like it's almost like they jumped over something because of the lack of that infrastructure. Because I remember in the United States, desktop computers were the thing for a while. Over there, it was laptops, and that's because you have the power going on and off and being unpredictable. Laptop, you could charge it up, and you didn't have to deal with the consequences of when the power goes out when you're using a desktop. So it's like portable and chargeable devices just became something very quick over there and kind of took on their own paths. And I find that absolutely fascinating.
The New York Times says your work combines, quote, politically complex science fiction and lyrical fantasy, unquote. What does that mean?
High compliments. I think it means that within the world that I portray in my work, you can have the technologically advanced in the same story as something magical happening. And for me, a lot of that stems from the fact that I'm writing what I consider to be African science fiction. So if you're really looking at what is African science fiction, that would embody, at least for me, mine is particularly West African. And a lot of West African beliefs include the mystical along with the mundane worlds coexisting. So for something magical to happen is completely normal. And so if you take that way of thinking, that worldview, and combine it with looking into the future, for example, that's how you have the science fictional with the fantastical happening.
So it's already in the water within the cultural frame that you're jumping off from.
Yes, yes, very much so. It's part of what it is. It is what it is, exactly what it is, if that makes sense.
Well, speaking of all of that, I want to bring in Afrofuturism and Afrofuturism 2.0. How do you define that, and how is it being represented in popular science fiction culture?
I have a very tenuous relationship with the term Afrofuturism. It's like, I love it, but I hate it at the same time.
A healthy suspicion?
Yeah, and I'll use it. I'll call my work Afrofuturist, but only some of them. Some of them mm-hmm. I will not. Like Binti is, I think, very clearly Afrofuturist. Lagoon, clearly Afrofuturist. Akatawich, no. So, but my issues with Afrofuturism is that Afrofuturism historically has had, the foundation is American.
Right.
It's African-American. And because of that foundation, I find it problematic because I think the root of Afrofuturism should be African.
Sure.
It needs to be African and then branch out just the way its peoples did, branch out into the diaspora. So it's like when a lot of people talk about Afrofuturism, and I notice this, when they start listing names, most of them are African-American.
Right.
And for me, I have a very tenuous relationship with the label of African-American as well. I consider myself Nigerian-American, but that's a whole other discussion. But that will get lots of people angry or whatever, thinking, hopefully. But I think that because of that, it marginalizes and often makes invisible African science fiction. So it's like Afrofuturism, it's a term from over the years where at first it started off describing P-Funk and Sun Ra
right.
music. And then now it's changed some. But I think that also another issue that I have with Afrofuturism is that it seems to embody too many things that have nothing to do with each other. And so because of that, basically what gets labeled as Afrofuturist is Black people and a mention of space. I think that's very vague, and I think that's reductive.
Right, well, it sounds like you're saying that the term itself almost has, it has this frame built into the term that makes you think it's looking at a wider lens, but you're pointing mm-hmm. out that because it stems from African-American, that it's not as wide a lens as it might purport to be.
Yeah, yes. But that said, on the good side, I think that because of the label, I think, and because people are able to describe it, I think that it's also led people to notice this type of writing more. And in noticing it, they're able to say, oh, okay, this exists. Oh, yeah. Okay. African-rooted science. That's what I call it, African-rooted science fiction. that it exists and people are doing it and they're imagining futures and they're imagining African-rooted science fiction. So I think that that's where I am with it at this point.
That naming something complex is both an opportunity and a danger.
Yes, exactly. It's a very concise way of saying what I couldn't.
Do you find science fiction, it sounds like it gives you a form of cultural introspection.
Yeah, I would say that. But I'm already culturally introspective to begin with.
Right.
I mean, growing up as a Nigerian American who's really awake and interested in both sides, like I grew up in the United States and had to deal with a lot of heavy racism in the neighborhoods that I grew up in. Like, we were the first Black family to move into our neighborhood, and I had to deal with that with immigrant parents who came from a different part of the world who were not familiar with that history. They're familiar with the history, but from a different perspective.
Right.
So I was dealing with that, and I've seen the ugliness and the beauty of the United States, but the same can go with Nigeria when I would visit there and just, my siblings and I, we wouldn't hide. We'd just go out and participate and try and be made fun of and experience. So it's like, you know, we bring those two things together and I'm always, so because of that, I'm always thinking about culture. It's always been something I've had to deal with. So I bring that to science fiction. I just naturally bring that because that has been my own background. You know, in the United States, I deal with schisms between Africans and African Americans. You go to Nigeria, then you have to you're on the other side of it where you're talking about you're trying to explain African Americans to Africans, and so it's like it's just so much. And then so you bring all of that to a science fictional setting, and it just explodes. It's incredible. I mean, there's so many stories there. People are always like, "Oh, how do you come up with your stories?" I'm like, "Oh, really? I don't have to come up with anything. I just have to look around. It's all there."
Obviously, early science fiction had frequently to do with colonialism and manifest destiny. But what does the widening of that lens have to teach Western culture and science fiction in general?
Yeah, I think that classic science fiction has always been obsessed with colonialism and xenophobia and actually like viewing aliens as others. I think that with the inclusion of other types of ideologies and other types of cultures and other types of worldviews, of course you're going to see an opening up of what science fiction is. One of the things that I love about science fiction is that it's all about speculating. It's all about questioning and thinking about like what if this happened or what if that happened, and in the future, what if this happened? Even in the past, what if this happened? And when you're looking at those questions, if you're from a specific worldview, you're going to come at those questions in one way. So when you bring in people from different worldviews coming at that question, they're going to come at it in multiple ways, a plethora of ways, and I think it's just going to open us up to seeing more. It's just going to open us up to more.
Yeah, I read the Three Body Problem trilogy earlier this year, and I was fascinated to read science fiction from a Chinese cultural perspective. It was maybe the most arresting and shocking part of reading that, because it had never occurred to me, of course, being from the West, to think about it from this other perspective.
I think that's one exceptional example of what can be and what is coming.
Do you think that there are cultural boundaries that science fiction has yet to cross?
I mean, there are always going to be these boundaries that are there that need to be overcome. But I think that right now, there are a lot of boundaries that are being overcome. I can see changes over the last 10 years. Like, I can see it, you know, and that's a beautiful thing. I am all about dialogue, even if it gets ugly. Mm-hmm. I think that when there is dialogue, that's better than when there's silence.
Yeah.
Because when there is silence, that's when bad things happen.
Yeah.
So like, I am all about the dialogue and the argument and all of that. I'm glad to see it. And some of it is nasty. These things don't happen in one fell swoop.
Right.
They have to, like, improvement and change. You take three steps forward, two steps back, and then another two steps forward. It's going to be a back and forth for a while now. But I think we're on the road to something. So I feel confident.
I'm curious what your idea is. Why is science fiction still a marginalized genre? Mm. Still within the world of literature, it's considered a lesser genre.
That is a question I have been grappling with since I started writing it, because I started writing science fiction while I was in college, and I have two masters and a PhD, and throughout that whole time I was told by professors, one, not to write fantasy or science fiction, that those are not considered real literature. I was told point blank, you would come into workshops and the first thing they would say, no science fiction or fantasy in this class. No explanation. Yeah. So my first book was published in 2005. And I remember even back then, there were, especially when I was in Nigeria, there would be this kind of thing where real literature had to be about issues. It had to be things fall apart. You know, it had to be like deal with those tough African, quote unquote, issues.
Right.
You know, and if it didn't, you weren't writing real literature. You were writing like kids stuff. And that was only in 2005.
Wow.
And I remember there was a contest, a very prominent literary contest, and I won't name what it was, very prominent, that it was for African writers. And they were like, okay, we want narratives from African writers and send your novels to us for this contest. And one of their stipulations was no science fiction or fantasy.
Wow.
And I remember I was flabbergasted because if you look at African narratives, there is magic in African. You can't say no fantasy. That is an oxymoron.
There right.
It's part of the culture. So I think there's like some policing going on there.
Sure.
That's,
you wouldn't do it with South American literature.
Yes, exactly. So that was where I first encountered that. And then since then, I see how even some of the most prized awards will not consider science fiction or fantasy. I've seen it. Or
really?
Any kind of genre writing. And it's I'm still trying to figure it out. My theory with academia is that a lot of these professors are not well versed in science fiction and fantasy, and the only thing that they've seen are the bad stuff, and they highlight the bad stuff as if literature, whatever, doesn't have bad. Like there isn't bad literary literature. There's plenty of it out there.
Right.
So I think that's where that comes from. Is sort of ignorance about the about science fiction and fantasy, and then also a reluctance to not be ignorant, which means they'd have to kind of study it. You know, there's still that weird snobbery.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't know if it has to do with science fiction, people loving it so much, that therefore, if people love it so much, it can't be great literature.
Wow.
I don't know
right.
if it's that.
It's the hipster disease. Everyone's into this and I'm not in it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a little bit of that going on. The rest, I'm really not sure. And I think we really need to get over it, though. I feel like it's probably kept certain great works from ever being written. And I just worry for them because, you know, they are being, their muse is being stifled by this. And it's really unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. So knowing that, as a college professor, how should you approach teaching the next wave of science fiction writers?
I think that people who teach new science fiction writers are going to have to develop a structure that is not structured, if that makes sense. One that is malleable. One that shifts, because that's what the next generation is coming with. They're coming with so much movement, so many different sides and just shifting, and I think that teachers have to be ready for that. And for me, I'm naturally, that's something that comes easily to me because I'm used to shifting.
Right.
You know, I'm used to moving in through different perspectives and points of views. So when I encounter a different kind of point of view, I can adjust to that very easily. And I think that professors are going to need to, and teachers need to, be able to do that. And being able to open a student's mind even when your mind isn't quite at that thing yet either. So it's going to be like learning from the student, and the teacher will be learning from each other, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where do you see science fiction evolving?
Who knows? I mean, well, what's funny is that right now, And I think this will shift. But right now, there are things that are happening, especially here in the United States, where it's like, where it's catching up with the science fiction. Like today is catching up with the future, with future imaginings.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, where you're like, oh my God, okay. Because I keep reading about, especially on Twitter, these science fiction writers who are like, okay, I have to rewrite my book now because what I was writing about just happened. So so there's that, which is fascinating and terrifying at the same time. But I do think that, science fiction is about to go in many different directions at the same time, which is cool. Like we're gonna see a lot of different types, a lot of different cultural backgrounds getting into the mix. And when that happens, there will be an introduction of new ideas, new types of storytellings, and new perspectives that people from other parts of the world have never seen before. And when that happens, they'll be affected by that, and then it will be sort of just more affecting. So I think that's what I mean by I think that science fiction is about to go in many different directions at the same time. And I think it's going to be fascinating and glorious.
It seems like it even in the movies where Marvel is embracing more diverse cultures, Ta-Nehisi Coates writing for Black Panther. It feels like the frame is widening.
I've felt for a long time that was all just a matter of time. I'm like, when are they going to get a clue? Because I know they followed the money.
Right.
So, you know, and the world is a big place. So yeah, I think that we're seeing it. I think that because of this expansion, you know, when my daughter has a pet crayfish and... when it gets bigger, it molts. So it outgrows its shell,
mm-hmm.
and so it has to molt. And so when it molts, sometimes she feels that it's it might be painful, you know, when it's getting out of its new shell, and then once it gets out of the new shell, it has its nice new shiny shell, and that has to harden, and then it eats the old shell. Well, I think that's a nice
that's a lovely metaphor.
So I think that we're molting, and I think that that can be painful and disturbing. And I've often wondered if the crayfish understands what's happening to it as
right.
it's happening. Thought about that. And if it doesn't, is it confused? Is it scared? So you can also apply that to the way people feel now. Like I think that's what's happening. I think that's what's going to happen with science fiction. It's molting. There.
That
I like that.
Is as lovely a place as I could possibly imagine to finish this interview. Nnedi Okorafor, before I let you go, I have a lightning round of some questions that I want to ask you.
Okay.
witches or Jedis?
Jedis.
Hard copy or electronic book?
Oh, God, come on. okay, let's see. Hard copy.
Protagonist or antagonist?
Protagonist.
Simulation or reality?
Reality.
And lastly, time travel, jump ahead or jump back?
Jump ahead.
You've identified yourself as an optimist now.
I know. I'm an irrational optimist.
Nnedi Okorafor, thank you so much for being on this podcast. This was an absolute delight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure. And thanks for having me. This was fun.
Many thanks to Nnedi Okorafor for being here and to you for listening to Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. And be sure to check out our other episodes with wonderful guests like Kevin Kelly, Chris Hardwick, Sana Amanat, and Doug Chang. For more about the podcast, visit us at sci-fi.com.